You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, August 13th, 2020. I'm Matt Leck on a Matt, Brendan, Jamie, and Matt Binder Thursday. Broadcasting closer to the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal than ever before in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a throwback Michael interview. This time, his first interview on the Lula Lavajato scandal in Brazil. It's amazing because this is in 2016, very early after I started. And Michael knows pretty much everything and has the right analysis right from the beginning. Also on the program, the United States reported more than 1,500 new deaths caused by COVID-19 on Wednesday, our deadliest day since May. Some more awful numbers. 7.8 million children are in households behind on rent. 6.5 million didn't get enough to eat. And 3.4 million are in both situations. A top Fed official says we reopened too quickly for a V-shaped recovery. The Trump administration will now attempt to make that a matter of handwriting. Just under a million unemployment claims filed last week, the first time that number wasn't over a million since March. The bad news is these numbers are expected to be more permanent than the early filings, and the pace of hiring has slowed. As this economic catastrophe accelerates, McConnell and the Trump administration look ready to hold further coronavirus relief hostage into September. Also, mail sorting equipment is being pulled from the post office as Trump's deliberate sabotage on the U.S. Postal Service continues. And in Bolivia, this is day 11 of the general strike and blockade in protest of the right-wing coup government leader Jeanine Añez repeatedly delaying the Bolivian elections. Who would have thought that an unelected reactionary would have trouble administering elections that would remove them from power that she didn't win democratically to begin with? All that and more on today's Majority Report. You know, I'm trying to write these headlines and you want to write some jokes into it. And then it's like, oh, millions of kids hungry and facing possible eviction. Grim times. Hi, Brendan. How are you?
Hey, Matt. Yeah, I can sympathize with that. There's nothing funny about that at all.
No, it's brutal. I hope everyone's doing well listening to this. I know there's a lot of pain going on right now because of the lack of response that this government's having for the coronavirus. Another news, today would have been Michael's 37th birthday. It's a Michael Thursday throwback. So happy birthday out there, Michael. I just want to set up this interview quick before we get to it, make sure I have it ready. This was April 19th, 2016. Again, I have to say this is exactly 3 years to the day that our Los Angeles live show was, which was maybe the triumphant moment of TMBS for me in my mind. So 3 years before that LA live show, he was doing his first full show on what was going on with Lula, the Lavajato Lawfare coup, and what was going on with Dilma Rousseff too. Michael's analysis is, and the questions he asks here are very astute right from the beginning. I mean, he'd been doing this for a while. He did some of it with Binder too, but this is him really kind of coming into his own. And it's funny, people always made fun of Michael for how much he talked in interviews. And I can say that that's hard to do and sound not like an idiot. I interviewed one of Michael's friends, Drew Mikhail, with David Griscom and Leisha Brooks on TMBS on Tuesday night about the Beirut explosion and the rage. And interviewing is something that I'm going to have to, you know, learn to do a little bit better. And it's difficult. And so I watched these early Michael interviews with a lot of admiration because he's very good at setting things up, putting things on the table, putting too much things on the table. But I think it's better to put too much on the table than too little. So yeah, we're going to go with this, this now. This is with Anthony Pereira. I believe he's a professor. Michael will introduce him. And it's about a half-hour-long interview. And we will see. We'll do a clip with Jamie and maybe Matt Binder, I think, before the fun half. So we'll see you folks in about a half an hour.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Professor Anthony Pereira. He is the director of the Brazil Institute at King's College, London. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
So wanted to speak with you about this unfolding crisis in Brazil. There is a pretty sort of broad narrative to this that you see in, you know, the American press, and actually apparently emanating from a lot of the Brazilian press, that this is a simple question of corruption, civil society uprising. It seems to be a bit more complicated than that. But in order to situate the conversation, can you help anchor us in understanding who these two figures are? That's Lula, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, President Dilma Rousseff. He was the former president, and he's a founder of the Workers' Party, which they are both members of. Take us into their history, maybe starting with Lula.
Right. These two figures, Lula and Dilma, in a way represent two of the most important forces in the Workers' Party. It was formed at the end of the 1970s. And one anchor of it was the trade union movement. So the trade union movement in the ABC region, the auto, mostly auto workers, had some strikes in 1979 that really defied the military dictatorship. Brazil had a dictatorship from 64 to 79, to 85. And Lula, as the leader of the auto workers in that region, emerged as one of the key leaders of the opposition to the military dictatorship. So he became president of the party early on. He was always the most important leader. He ran for president in 89, 94, 98, and finally won presidency in 2002. Dilma comes out of the armed left because there were some mostly young people, mostly students, who decided in the late 60s, when the regime got much more repressive and cracked down, they decided to take up arms. And so there were lots of kind of splintered left groups. The Communist Party was actually not in favor of armed action against the dictatorship. And a lot of them were very severely dealt with. So Dilma herself was arrested, tortured quite badly, and ended up 3 years as a prisoner. And so those two forces came together in the late 70s, early 80s. And they were also joined by people who were influenced by liberation theology. And the Workers' Party also attracted a lot of middle-class intellectuals, people from the universities, people from the public sector. And it was a really small party at the beginning. And in fact, a lot of its features were that it was more of a sort of conglomeration of social movements than it was an actual political party. And there was a really interesting internal debate in the party in the 1980s of how much like a professional party they should become. But they did become a very professionalized party. They started winning a lot of mayorships, a lot of governorships. And as I said, they got the presidency in 2002. Lula's administration started in 2003. And they've now had they've been the major party in a coalition government at the national level for 14 years. So part of what this is about is getting the Workers' Party out of that position.
Absolutely. And we'll certainly get to that. But underlie this history, it actually reminds me in some ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a debate in the 80s in European, particularly German Green Party, between the kind of realos or fundies, and that similar kind of debate. Or are we sort of a political party that organizes activists, or do we want to actually take and assume power? And Lula, I believe, ran for the presidency of Brazil three times before winning in 2002. What did he have to do, both in terms of the kind of practical mechanisms inside the Workers' Party and in terms of his broader image, just even from a PR perspective for the public, or from a policy perspective, his commitments on macroeconomic policy to get there on the fourth try?
That's a great question, because that is a pivotal moment in the history of the party. As you said, it had a kind of Green Party social movement feel to it for a long time, and it was always internally quite democratic and very programmatic and ideological. It was not into the kind of trading of favors that's common in other parties in Brazil at that time in its history. After Lula lost the third time in 98, he went to the party and he said, I will be willing to run again, but I need to have more control over the campaign. It's going to be a Lula campaign and not a PT campaign. And the party conceded to that request, and he ran in 2002 with a conservative sort of center-right vice presidential candidate from the Liberal Party, who was actually evangelical. He made a broad coalition. He wrote a letter to the Brazilian people in the summer of 2002 in which he said that he would respect contracts and he would respect the debt that Brazil had at that time with the IMF. So he sort of accepted the macroeconomic framework that existed at that time, which was quite neoliberal, and he ran on a much broader coalition, and he changed his image. He talked about peace and love. He had nicely tailored suits. He trimmed his beard. He looked a lot more. He looked a lot less threatening,
less militant, more cuddly.
Exactly. Became cuddly. Became kind of avuncular. Softened his tone, and so he won in 2002. And I would say between 2002 and then 2006, when he gets reelected, he actually also shared the spoils of governance more. He brought in the PMDB to a greater extent. That's the kind of center-right party that's now against Dilma Rousseff, but they were his allies at that point. And I think one of the really interesting things that happens between the 2002 and 2006 election is that Lula loses a lot of his middle-class support. Between 2002 and 2006, partly because his economic policies were trying to target the poor. Mm-hmm. The rich were doing very well, the poor were doing quite well, and the middle class wasn't really getting that much. So they abandoned him to quite a large extent. But he picks up the unorganized poor, the people who are really on low incomes, and that's more than compensates for his loss of middle class support, but it's a very different sort of base of support for Worker Party presidents since the 2006 election. And you can pretty much go down the income scale. As you go down in income, you're more likely to find people who vote for PT presidential candidates.
Because there's no doubt, just as an addendum, that it seems very clearly established that, you know, regardless of any, you know, decisions or corruption or anything else, both the administrations of Lula and Dilma have certainly delivered in some ways for the extreme poor. Like, that support from the poor is not just symbolic. It's been very real. It's been real delivery that's made a difference in income, food security, and everything else. That has been a very successful and real part of both of their records, and probably particularly Lula. So what strikes me, though, as you say this, and which is fascinating, and I want you to kind of use this question to lead us into the present accusations and present crisis. But in the Western press, or not the, in the American press, the European press, when Lula was first kind of emerging on the stage, and through, like, as you say, his first term, and then there was a kind of broad period, I think, you know, Lula left office as probably the most popular politician in the world who actually faces democratic accountability. He was extraordinarily popular. Right. There was this idea that, you know, that was always reported that, you know, he started on the hard left, and now he's, you know, he's kind of, you know, he's center leftish. He's kind of a social democrat. People even compared him to sort of the Tony Blair, Bill Clinton vein, which I think is a stretch, to be fair to Lula, frankly. Yeah. But what struck me, especially as this scandal has kind of unfolded, was that part of quote unquote moderating in Brazilian politics is making peace and alliances with systemic corruption. So in a certain sense, it's this inversion now where, oh, all of a sudden, you know, Lula and Dilma have been so corrupt, supposedly, but accepting and acquiescing to a certain degree of that was part and parcel of the first moderation image, which everybody wanted to praise him for. So if you could kind of riff on that and then use that to open up what's happening now, that would be great.
Sure. I mean, I think what you bring up is a really important point, and it's why that there are, you know, there are people on the left in Brazil who feel really let down by the Workers' Party, who thought that the Workers' Party, because it was at least in opposition, principled and ethical and talked about transforming Brazil and transforming the traditional corrupt way of doing politics in Brazil, you know, they feel let down because rather than the PT really changing the political system, they were in fact changed by it, and they became more like all those other politicians and parties that they criticized when they were in opposition. But in some ways, you know, I think it was, and I think Lula has a lot to do with this. Lula was never really highly ideological. He wasn't someone who was steeped in the history of the labor movement, for example, or about socialism. He was a very pragmatic negotiator. He was a good negotiator. He would get good deals for his members. And I think that was, he was always that kind of trade union leader who would talk to everybody and seek a consensus. Right. And he had around him when he was elected in 2002, a team of people like José Dirceu, who was his chief of staff, and Palocci, who was his finance minister, who were also extremely powerful, extremely pragmatic and oriented towards power. And they realized, you know, we have to have, we can maintain party discipline and we can be focused on program, but we know that all of these other parties are not.
Right.
And so we're going to have to play ball with them, and we're going to have to give them parts of the federal budget. We're going to have to give them ministries. And of course, you know, I think there's pretty compelling evidence that they got involved in the same sorts of corruption that other parties and politicians have been involved in. So in a way, it was the price that they felt, I think, that they were willing to pay to change Brazil and to do some of the things that they did, which was, for example, this conditional cash transfer program, which lifted people out of poverty, the you know, increasing access to university and technical education through a really big loans program to students. Loan and grant program to low-income students, affirmative action in the universities, trying to promote gender equality, all of these things. So, you know, in their minds, I think these pragmatic compromises were what they needed to do to deal with the reality of the Brazilian political system.
What are some of the specifics of some of these corruption allegations targeting Dilma and Lula, and how has the judiciary, it seems, again, like there's probably some legitimacy to some of these charges, and if you could, you know, outline them, that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. you know, it does seem at the very least that, as an example, you know, leaking conversations that are part of an investigation between Lula and Dilma in an effort to embarrass them is, you know, at the very least questionable.
Exactly.
And even as, you know, they have been targeted, all of the major political parties are implicated in this. So, you know, I guess play out that contradiction there.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, we saw this spectacle on Sunday of the members of the lower house voting to impeach Dilma. And the guy presiding over that session was Eduardo Cunha, who's been charged by the attorney general of receiving a $5 million bribe to get a company, a contract from Petrobras, the state-owned oil company, and of also having undeclared bank accounts in Swiss banks with millions of dollars in them. So, right. You know, this is not a spectacle in which clean politicians are impeaching a corrupt one. There's, you know, corruption is endemic in Congress. What the car wash investigations have revealed, investigation led by a judge called Sergio Moro in Curitiba. What they found was that, and what they're alleging, is that big that had contracts with Petrobras would routinely over invoice or over bill for those contracts. The kickbacks would then go to executives in the oil company, but they would also be funneled to politicians for campaigns. And if you read the Brazilian press, you'd be forgiven for thinking PT was the only party benefiting from this scheme, but this was a very, very widespread scheme and involved a lot of parties in the coalition.
Professor,
about 50 people.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Have you moved or anything? Because your connection was excellent, and we've just gotten a bit choppy.
Okay, I think I moved away from the mic there.
Oh yes, get back to the mic, please. Thank you.
Is that better?
That's significantly better. Yes, great.
Okay,
go right ahead.
So there's about fifth Congress who have been implicated in this car wash investigation for this in this kickback scheme, and that includes Edmund of the lower house. It includes Michel Temer. The thing is, Dilma, there's no evidence that is produced yet that Dilma, you know, benefited from any of this corruption, but right. She was chairman of the board on Petrobras during Lula's second term. So, you know, there might, what her critics allege is that there's a sin of omission, if not commission, in terms of her role in Petrobras, an oil company. But that's not actually the subject of the impeachment charge.
Yeah, what exactly, because that's the other kind of odd thing about it with regards to Dilma, what is the impeachment charge against her, and how does she sort of get dragged into what, as you already outlined, first of all the parties are implicated. Mm-hmm. In fact, it seems on the face of it, and again, yeah, not to, you know, obviously I sort of have a personal soft spot for Lula, that's clear, and I have a kind of more general sympathy to the Workers' Party, but you know, the evidence against Lula might be there, but it's certainly more tenuous than it is for many other leading players in this, where it seems a lot more clear in terms of, you know, money in accounts and things actually moved. But with Dilma, it seems like,
right,
I mean, there's literally nothing there. It's just, you know, it's as if they got the Republicans had the votes together to just impeach Obama because they don't like him.
Yeah, I think it's not a very robust case. I mean, you do get constitutional lawyers saying that this is an impeachable offense. But just to point out how paradoxical the whole thing is, you know, she's accused of signing orders that delayed payment banks so that the fiscal deficit looked lower than it actually was. This is something, these same orders have been signed by Michel Temer, the vice president, who's scheduled to take over from her as an interim president once the Senate accepts these impeachment proceedings. So I think it looks like a double standard. It looks like selective invocation of the law. And in fact, these are common practices in mayorships and governorships. They've been done by previous presidents. The jurisprudence that declares that these are unconstitutional acts is very recent. And we have to remember, too, in November of 2014, right after her reelection, there were people calling for impeachment then.
Right.
They didn't have a reason for it. They just were upset that she had won reelection. And this was the fourth consecutive Workers' Party presidential victory. So I think it was something that was convenient. And what was noticeable about the Sunday vote in the lower house is that almost nobody voting yes mentioned these pedaladas, as they're called, or these sort of creative bookkeeping acts of Dilma. They talked about the Petrobras corruption. They talked about morality. They talked about their families. They talked about, how the country was ungovernable and how the economy had to improve. I mean, it was so diffuse that everything was invoked almost, very rarely the actual impeachment charges were mentioned.
Well, that's actually brings me to a couple of interconnected things here too, because as I say, Lula left office, I believe it was in 2012 or 2010. I don't remember the specific year.
2010. Yeah.
2010. Yeah. And he left, as I say, as with one of the most, I think, the highest approval rating of anybody in the world who was actually, you know, he wasn't Gaddafi, right? Like, these were real polls. Right. Everybody loved him. He was incredibly popular. And, you know, Dilma, who has this fascinating personal background, but did not have an electoral political background, he kind of handpicked her. She didn't have the same kind of charisma that he had, but she's obviously, you know, very smart, very capable. And with his stamp of approval, she was elected and then reelected on her own merits in 2014. And so it seems like, you know, one track that's happened here is that the Brazilian economy has just stalled, and that always creates general anger. So that's kind of,
right.
So those tracks of, okay, we don't have a president who's as charismatic or persuasive. The economy stalled. And then the third track seems to be that, you know, the level of opposition from the media to the opposition parties, to the judiciary, seems to kind of, you know, it sort of seems to indicate we could never win. It looks like Lula might run again in 2018. And yeah. We're not, like, we just have to stop them somehow. And Lula, yeah. Ironically, for a guy who, you know, really moderated to get himself where he was and with all that entailed, you know, he's out speaking to the international press saying, like, look, this is a kind of old style Latin American coup. And mm-hmm. almost as if the lesson after all of this time and power, and even in today's modern circumstances, that the old oligarchic dynamics are still at play, and even a moderation, as much as the Workers' Party and the delivery across sectors, is still not going to work, because fundamentally the elites don't want us to govern. And that seems like what the fault lines have turned into.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the contrast between the really rough time that Dilma's having and the much easier time that Lula had, I think it's based on three limitations of Workers' Party rule. I guess the fourth could be there is misogyny in society as well. Sure. And I think that's a factor that plays against Dilma in the same way that it plays against Hillary Clinton, say, in this system. Right. But the three limitations are, one is that I think Lula personalized the party in a way that probably wasn't healthy. So rather than a competitive election inside the party, what you had in 2010 was him as this very popular president saying, I'm going to pick this woman who's my chief of staff, who's never won an election to anything, mm-hmm. and she's going to be my successor. And I think that sort of went against the tradition of the Workers' Party, which was to be programmatic, to be internally democratic, and to be more about to be a party that was kind of bigger than any individual in it. So people started talking in 2010 about Lulismo or Lulaism, mm-hmm. as opposed to PTism or the worker. So the person started to become more important than the party. And that's a limitation, I think. And you can see it in the lack of other candidates. So Lula's the only plausible candidate for them in 2018. Mm-hmm. The second limitation, I think, is that they did help the poor, but they helped the poor mostly through mechanisms that increase the purchasing power of the poor. So increasing access to credit, the social transfers. So you got a social income if you were really poor, access to training and education that lowered the skills gap in the labor market. What they weren't able to do as much is structurally transform the country. So, for example, improve the quality of education, improve the quality of healthcare, mm-hmm. Provide good public transportation. So as purchasing power was going up amongst the lower income, and you got the growth of what the Brazilians call class C, between a, you know, sort of 1,000 and 4,000 reais. They call it a middle class, but it's really, we'd probably understand it as a working class. You didn't get the corresponding improvements in public goods that would have made people's lives better. So mm-hmm. you had more people buying cars and worse traffic. You had crime was bad because public security wasn't keeping up with the rates of crime. You had sort of unlivable situations for a lot of commuters in cities. And that was a big limitation. And I think the final limitation is that when they went in 2006 and they set that pattern of getting most of their votes from the low income, it worked electorally, but what it meant was a lot of the shapers of opinion in institutions like the judiciary, in institutions like the media, to a lesser extent in universities. There's still a lot of supporters of the Workers' Party in universities. But outside of that, most middle-class people are anti-Workers' Party. It set a dynamic in which they could win elections, but they didn't have a big cross-class coalition that could make the case for their legitimacy throughout the whole society. And you got this polarization. If you're depending mostly on the bottom half of the income distribution, you can win the votes. When it comes time to debates like these things about the impeachment, the loudest voices in these discussions are often the anti-Workers' Party voices. And you've got an electorate in Brazil, 60% of the people don't identify with any party. And The Workers' Party has the highest party identification in the electorate, but it's only about 10-11%, and it's probably actually, that's, you know, a little while ago, it's probably fallen since then, and they have to deal with a Congress which has about 28 different parties, so they, I think that lack of a cross-class coalition is really in terms of their electoral support means that they're constantly getting hammered by the media, by the mainstream media. And I think the judiciary as well has been, as you point out, with these leaks, it's been highly selective in the information that it's leaked. And it's tended to target the Workers' Party, even though the corruption is much more generalized and systematic.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, as we move towards the final sort of question here, but just to underlie that, it seems like in these two sort of failings of the Workers' Party, and again, I mean, obviously there's a major problem in terms of the way the judiciary, other political parties, and the media have acted and are acting. I think arguably they're seriously undermining the democratic credibility of Brazil in some respects. But it's very interesting that in the failures to kind of keep a broad-based coalition, and then in the kind of failures to address more structural deficits, there isn't the kind of structural people's lives are better, which you can never underestimate, but there isn't, sure. It's like, you know, as because Dilma's had to do austerity, and then, you know, right. And when you cleaned up, we did a report, you know, on what happened during the World Cup, and, you know, certainly the Workers' Party government was quite, you know, brutal in enforcing the edicts of, you know, the World Cup, and that's contradictory on every level of the kind of traditional Worker Party ethos. So
right.
By not doing those kind of deeper, more durable jobs, ironically, that wasn't pragmatic because it set the stage for its own crisis in a certain way.
Absolutely. And you know, one way to look at this impeachment, and it doesn't jive with the sort of gulp or coup rhetoric, is that this is an inside job. This is the PT's own coalition partner, the PMDB, deciding to dump them. And to get rid of the president, and they're doing it very well because the PT has been so dependent on these guys. It's a bit like House of Cards, you know. Michel Temer, the vice president, is leading the coalition in the lower house to vote against his own president. But I think you could fault the Workers' Party on environmental issues and indigenous issues as well. When you saw how the Dilma Rousseff government reacted to the Belo Monte controversy, the big dam in the Amazon, you know, and these structural transformations are hard. I mean, they would, for example, they could have tried to change the tax system. You know, Brazilians, the overall level of taxation in the economy is high, but the highest tax rate is 27%. There's very little taxation of wealth, land, and property. They could have tried to take that on. You know, they could have tried structural reforms. Those were difficult to do, and I suppose you could say that they're paying the price for that in a way. I mean, under Lula, it was very significant that not only poverty decreased, but income inequality, as measured by the Gini coefficient, came down. And that was really significant because that hadn't happened in a long time in Brazil. And Brazil is still one of the most unequal countries in the world when it comes to the distribution of income. But what did not get looked at during that period was, of course, inequality of wealth. And this is why Thomas Piketty's book is very relevant to Brazil, because wealth inequality, I mean, we don't really know, we don't really have the statistics, but wealth inequality may well be greater even than income inequality. And there are lots of ways for the wealthy to hang on to their wealth in Brazil. And, you know, that was something that the Workers' Party just wasn't able or willing to take on. And I think that's where a really interesting debate on the left is happening, is sort of what could the Workers' Party have done that they didn't do? How much allowance do you have to give for the realities of the Brazilian political system? And I think there are some people who are a little bit starry-eyed who say that the Workers' Party could have absolutely transformed Brazil. And we have to remember, Lula got something like 60% of the vote typically in his two elections for president in the second round. His party never got more than about 30% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So they were coming into Congress where they had maybe 20% of the seats in both houses, and they had to transform those 20% into a majority in the Congress. That's how difficult the system is.
Right.
So I think you do have to make some allowances for how that system works.
Absolutely. I mean, and as a final question, and this is the sort of, you know, generic, impossible to answer question, but take it in any direction you want to take it in. You know, what's the sort of general what happens next from, you know, the most kind of immediate to even the relevancy of that conversation inside the left in Brazil? I mean, you know, whatever you think is most relevant in terms of what's going to kind of come out of this.
Sure. Yeah, I watched that vote on Sunday, and there was a kind of climate of a big party. You know, when the 342nd deputy voted to impeach, there's this sense that this is it's going to be a big change in Brazilian politics. I think it's just one little step and an unfolding drama. It's not going to be easy for any government right now in Brazil to govern, whether it's led by Dilma Rousseff or Michel Temer, because the country is so polarized, and it's also paralyzed. The government isn't able to do the kinds of reforms that it needs to do to get out of recession. Now, you're looking at maybe a second year in a row where the economy contracts by almost 4%. This is a big crisis for Brazil. But I think in some ways, it wouldn't be terrible from the point of view of the left and the Workers' Party. They're not the same thing, but to go out of power at this point, to not have their president in, because they could rethink what their values are. They could prepare to run as an opposition party in 2018, and they could sort of have the kind of moment that the Labour Party's been having here in Britain with Jeremy Corbyn as its leader. Mm. You know, Corbyn is not really a plausible prime minister, I don't think, in anybody's mind, but he's brought in a huge sort of grassroots resurgence of people joining the party and remembering what they were really all, you know, what they were interested in before Blair and New Labour sort of made them a kind of copy of the Conservatives. So I think that it wouldn't be entirely unhealthy for the Workers' Party to be out and to sort of rejuvenate itself, but then also for a really ample debate to happen, because it's not clear that the party is going to stay together. You may have people saying, well, you've already had a lot of defections, but you may have more, especially after the municipal elections that are coming up in October. You may have people like Tarso Genro from Rio Grande do Sul saying, this party, it's not going to work anymore as a vehicle for our aspirations. We have to find something else. So that could happen.
Fascinating. Professor Anthony Pereira, I appreciate your time immensely. And Professor Pereira is the director of the Brazil Institute at King's College in London. Thank you so much, Professor. I hope we have a chance to talk again sometime soon and kind of continue following what's happening even beyond the crisis point.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you.
All right, folks. There you have it. Another fun fact about that episode, that 4/19 2016 episode, is that's the first Michael day that Michael and I did solo in the studio. There's no Kelly that day, so it was just Michael and I. And I think that was probably the first time I ever did produce a show by myself at all, which was, you know, Brendan, I think you've done that before, right?
I've done it a few times, and I one time when you were out for TMBS, I produced a TMBS show without ever being a pre-production or anything like that, which was fun.
Interesting. I forgot all about that. let's let Jamie and Matt Binder in now. I don't know. Some pretty good. I mean, maybe some people might take exception to the Corbyn thing, although it kind of looked like that was the prevailing sentiment among British voting public. But overall, I think a very interesting interview. And it's funny how much of the talking points from Michael were the same and were validated. Hey, Matt.
Yep.
Hey, what's up? Do you hear me?
I do. Yep.
Perfect. I got my new setup for you guys today.
Yeah, that camera is something.
Yeah, right. Look, you can see me really good, can't you?
You guys are making me so jealous.
Yep. You know, just in time for Michael's birthday. I got to look good for Michael's birthday, you know?
Wait, so there's a new camera?
It is a new camera. I'm using like a legit like mirrorless Panasonic webcam, like and I got it connected to this HDMI input device that goes to my computer, and then I got my I still got the USB mic, but that's the next upgrade. That's the next upgrade.
I mean, I will say I kind of like the soft focus of my computer webcam because I feel less of a compulsion to like put on makeup or whatever. And, you know, I am above all things quite lazy. But, you know, I mean, I already got Sam to spring for this mic stand. So maybe, who knows? Maybe we can get a little extra technology going. I don't want to push it.
You got the better audio than me right now because I'm looking and that's an XLR cable going into your mic, which means that it's analog, which means it sounds better than my digital mic. So, you know, and this is primarily an audio show. So, I mean, you focused on the right thing, whereas I guess I'm vain and wanted to look good.
Well, I guess when it comes to my face, maybe I like to leave them wanting more. I don't know.
Ooh, I like that.
Guys, should we do this clip about Eric Trump talking about V-shaped recoveries?
Oh,
what's the V?
Yeah.
What's the V that the British people do? Is it this one where it's like it means like F you? Is it this one? Here's my V-shaped recovery. Here you go. Take that for your recovery.
The V is for victory. It's victory, folks. So yeah, noted economist Eric Trump appeared on Fox and Friends today with the unenviable task of spinning these latest unemployment numbers to make it look a little bit rosier. We've got nearly a million new jobless claims this week. Millions are under threat of eviction. And, you know, the pandemic is still killing people. But maybe you're just looking at it the wrong way.
All right, we've got a Fox News alert. Look at the number right there. The weekly jobless claims for first-time unemployment is out, and 963,000 filed for unemployment benefits for the first time last week.
Listen, it's not a great number, but in the scheme of things, it is a great number. That's less than what experts predicted. And the first time, claims fell below a million in 21 weeks.
About 57 million Americans have filed for unemployment since the pandemic started. That is the lowest number, under a million, since March. Let's bring in Eric Trump, Executive Vice President for the Trump Organization and son of our president. Good morning to you, Eric.
Good morning, guys. Good morning, Ainsley. Good morning. How are you?
We're great. When you hear that news, what are your thoughts?
Well, listen, if you look at the last 3 months, right, look at the last 3 months, 9.3 million Americans went back to work. If you look at last month alone, if you look at July, right, 1.8 million jobs were created, which blew away expectations. Then you look at, you know, this month, you look at the claim that you're talking about right now, you know, well under a million, which again blew away expectations. My father always said that you're going to have a V-shaped recovery. And look at where the Dow Jones is right now. I mean, the Dow Jones is at 28,000 right now. Look at where the NASDAQ is. NASDAQ is all-time highs. I mean, the Dow is literally 1,000 points off of all-time highs. You know what that means for, you know, 401ks and pension plans and our economy in general? Our economy is roaring back to life. It is roaring back to life. And we should all be very proud of that as Americans, as much as kind of the mainstream media wants to ignore it, guys.
Wow. It's roaring, folks. You hear that? So, like, I guess let's talk about a few different parts of this, so then we'll open it up to broader discussion. The jobs being created are largely not good ones. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I have seen news stories about Amazon going on a giant hiring spree. Like, they don't care if the jobs are good jobs. They just want to force people to work for not enough wages with not enough safety. But the stock market, okay, you know, maybe I'm homeless, I can't pay my rent, I can't afford to buy food, but my 401k, which is money that I don't actually get to have for years and years, that's doing great. Nothing to see here, folks, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's so aggravating. It reminds me of the CNBC segment from earlier. This was about in end of May. Andrew Ross Sorkin and Joe Kernan getting into a pretty heated argument because Joe Kernan's like, the numbers are great, Andrew. Why are you telling everyone to panic?
Like Tesla, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Andrew's like, well, people are dying and there's a tremendous amount of suffering. And it's like, and Kernan, well, I just want to play this. I have it here, actually. And we can look at who's... So, I mean, I don't think Andrew Ross Sorkin is exactly DSA, but, I mean, we can see whose side of the argument came
out
here.
Tell us about what's happening
right now.
Still
looking at the coincidence and lagging indicator. Let's see. For a while, it was how can stocks be where they are because of oil prices? Remember, that was your take then.
Right.
How can it be... Yep. Based on where interest rates are right now. Then it could be how can stocks be, right. And then it was every single discussion you have over the weekend is about how can stock prices be here when the economy is here. Right. Now it's going to be your earnings.
And just to be clear, it's because the Fed gave them trillions of dollars. That's why.
Nationalize the stock market, basically.
Yeah, that's something right. the CNBC doesn't really want to tell their, or explicitly say on broadcast.
Here. When the economy is here. Right. Now it's going to be your earnings, but can right. you see how that probably well, isn't the coincidence, the stuff Joe. Right in your face? We're going to have David Lebovitz on. He's going to say every client he talks to is asking him, how can the stock market be here when right. everything else is...
And that's the question. And there are a lot of smart people who have that view. You may
are
not
they?
Have that
are
view.
They, so, I know, is that you, the, how you, why you, is that the smart people? They've been wrong for 35%. Why are they smart? Just because they can see what's right in front of their nose? That doesn't make them smart. It makes them.
Look,
it makes
Joe,
them
you
not
missed
savvy
it all the way
about,
down too.
Makes them
Joe,
not savvy about the
Joe,
market.
Joe, you missed it. You missed Joe. You missed it 100% on the way down, and you missed 100,000 deaths. So we can have this debate back and forth, and you can try to question the questions I'm asking. But there are smart people, including your friend Stan Druckenmiller, who has argued that the market has been over. Hold on. I'm not going to do this with you, Joe. Every morning, you try to question the questions I'm asking. These are questions that investors are asking every single morning. I am just trying to get through some of this clutter. I may be right. I may be wrong. Investors may be right. They may be wrong. That's what makes a market. But it doesn't make people a good person or a bad person. It doesn't make it right to act the way you are. I'm sorry.
Okay. You yelled
I'm
at the poor guy about
hour.
The
I'm
guy
not.
Yesterday with masks. Is like, why are you yelling at
I'm
me
not,
now?
Joe.
You just yelled again. I don't
I'm
know.
Not.
I'm just trying to.
Go
I'm
ahead.
Just. I'm sorry.
No, you're not, Joe. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead with the news.
You panicked about the market, panicked about COVID, panicked about the ventilators, panicked about the PPE, panicked about ever going out again, panicked
and
that
you
we'd ever get
it.
Back.
By the way, PPE shortage is still occurring in various hospitals around the country. We still haven't right. sorted that problem out, even though it's, you know, it's kind of one of the, I don't want to even say it's minor. We should have absolutely sorted it out by now.
The normal.
Joseph, you didn't panic
what
about
good
anything.
That? What good is it? Why
Joseph,
not? Why 100,000 help
people die.
Keep their head. I understand
100,000 people died, Joe, and all you did was try to help your friend, the president. That's what you did. Every Ooh. Single morning on this show. Every single
yeah.
morning
it
on this
had,
show.
It had
you abused and abused your position,
that's
Joe.
That's totally unfair.
You abused and abused
I'm
your position.
I'm trying to help investors keep their cool, keep their heads. yeah. And as it turned out, that's
you
what they
Joseph?
Should have done. That's what they should
Do
have
the news.
Done. They should
Do
have
the news.
Kept their heads. If they had listened to you, Andrew, we're supposed to be at about 8,000.
Okay, so I think that's about enough of that. But I want to bring that up just in relation to this. Who is it at the on the Trump administration or I forget the news today? But admitting, like,
Matt
yeah,
Kudlow?
we tried. No, it wasn't Kudlow. Kudlow wouldn't admit something like this. It was some bureaucrat that said, "Yeah, we reopened too quickly to have a V-shaped recovery."
It was a Fed chair in Boston.
Yeah, we'd love to have had one. Like the other countries that actually shut things down and took care of this and got this shit under control. But we don't have that because we reopened too fast.
Can we talk about the concept of a V-shaped recovery in the first place? Like, what does that mean? Things get worse and then they get better again? It just seems like a really good way to spin it when things are getting worse. Like, no, this is only the first part of the V. The second yes. part is coming.
Yeah,
we're trying to address this in the most razor thin way possible, which is just to prop up the stock market and your 401k and just make the, you know, appearance that everything is good while people suffer daily and, you know, are going hungry.
I mean, I remember, you know, in 2011 in the studio, ragging on Andrew Ross Sorkin's reaction to Occupy Wall Street with Sam. So, I mean, just to hear that from him, I mean, a decade later still, but a decade later, nonetheless, I mean, people are realizing due to various different things that have been occurring what's going on? You know, like you mentioned, like he's not Andrew Ross Sorkin is in DSA, but this guy clearly has perhaps opened up to some things that are going on and how screwed up it all is.
Well, it's like the idea that you can't look beyond the media, and he's probably right from a terms of what the CNBC audience wants. Like, hey, how can I make money this moment? Right. Like, and probably the idea was to keep riding and not worry about all the deaths and what kind of long-term damage and depression that could sink us into.
But when they talk about the 401ks, they do have a bit of a point there, right? Because sure, most of the people making money off of the stock market are the 1%, and we don't care about them. But normal people's retirement savings are tied up in this insane system and being held hostage, so they can then turn around and say, oh, well, we're trying to sacrifice lives for the system, but we're doing it for your own good, people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so horrible that, like, watching the little tickers on CNBC is what people do to plan their retirements.
Well, defined benefit pensions used to be a thing, and now they are not a thing, to the point where Sean actually had to explain it to me when he had one, what exactly it was and what it did.
You know, the interesting thing about 401ks that I've been noticing recently is just how it's used to sort of separate people in terms of, like, for example, yesterday there was that story about Wall Street was parting it up over Joe Biden picking Kamala Harris for his VP. And I saw, you know, people on the left criticizing it, obviously. Oh, wonderful. They got someone they like. And you saw Democrats and liberals defending it, going, I'm glad Wall Street is happy because my 401k means it's going to do good. You know, I really do think it's a tool to, like, you know, to like really like separate certain like people who should be on the same side, but are slightly different classes, you know, in terms of Wall Street, at least.
And nobody has really had to retire yet on a 401k. That's the other insane thing about this. It's a relatively new innovation from the neoliberal era designed to take shift the burden from the bosses to the workers and other external factors for having a safe retirement. And I don't know. I don't really trust it. I've only ever had a 401k for like a year. I still have like $800 somewhere in a fund from that. It's just this exotic creature that comes in and out of my life, mostly out. But I feel like I'd do better just hiding some money under a mattress at this point.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, you have a generation of people, or two generations, if you include Gen X to this point, who for the most part have had success with the 401k. Like, their money has grown, but with the millennials and then Gen Z, if they even have a 401k, the majority of the time has been spent losing money in it. They have not gained anything from it. So, you know.
And now's a good time if you have parents who have retirements and are, you know, looking at this stuff closely, to say, like, you know what, you've worked all your life for this shit. Do you really think you should be having to monitor what's going on fucking Wall Street to determine the dignity of your retirement? And guess what? None of them will say, yes, I think I should have to do that. So get in there, folks, with that message.
Also, get in there and convince them to use some of that retirement fund money on Patreons for Matt, Jamie, and Brandon. You got a Patreon? I can't remember.
No, I don't.
I mean, okay. Well, you should start one. Communism is the ultimate retirement plan, and I think it's the one a lot of millennials and Zoomers are banking on. So to the degree that we spread communism and hasten the abolition of the value form, I'd say it's a great investment.
You heard it here first, folks. The Patreon for Antifada is a down payment on communism. who wants to go first? Matt, you want to go?
Sure. Well, looking forward to joining all of you in the second half of the show. But for those of you who are leaving us now, you can find me at youtube.com/Matt Binder. There is a live stream, a live show tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time on YouTube. I'll be talking with Angelo Caruso, with Media Matters. And we will be discussing the rise of QAnon in Washington. We're going to run through how basically Q is going to have a place on Capitol Hill come November, almost assuredly, with at least one race, possibly more. And, you know, really how the right wing has and the Trump sycophants have stoked QAnon to get to the where it is today, really. And we're going to go through all that. It'll be a great show. YouTube.com/Matt Binder. Also, Patreon.com/Matt Binder. And at Matt Binder on all social media channels if you want to follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever.
I'll go first. I'll go second, I guess. On Tuesday night, Dr. Drew Mikhael joined David Griscom, Leisha Brooks, and I to discuss the Beirut explosion and the rage. Basically, if last fall's WhatsApp protests were people coming across sectarian lines for a jubilant coming together against the elite, this blast has meant a sort of anger and rage across sectarian lines at the elite. So we got Drew's take on the explosion and the failure of the ruling elite there. As far as Literary Hangover goes, I will stream this weekend. I promise you folks. So twitch.tv/literary hangover, we will be doing a stream this weekend.
Heck yeah. I listened to some of that interview because I really want to learn more about what's going on in Lebanon and found it very informative. I really like the slogan, all of them means all of them. It seems like it has some real revolutionary, even anti-state potential.
It's it's pretty nuts over there right now. Like the day after, there was like flyers going around about like prepare the nooses and stuff like that. So they, they were storing thousands of pounds of ammonium nitrate in a port next to the grain silo, and they're already having problems with, you know, I mean, like we are, but during coronavirus and keeping everybody fed and stuff, and awful stuff. So yeah, check that interview out.
I can't wait for Kowalski to call in and explain to us the explosive properties of grain.
Yeah. Speaking of which, call lines will be open today. Matt Binder and our tech lord Kyle put in tireless work to make it happen. So call it.
Heck yeah. Thanks, guys. So I guess I'll do mine now. This week on the Antifada, we had on the elusive Virgil Texas of Chapo Trap House to talk about all of these open letters that older leftists are writing to younger leftists about how they need to vote for, work for, support, get married to. Little unclear. It's about Joe Biden. Talk about that. We talk about the COVID crisis, and it's great, folks. You're going to love it.
There you go. All right, folks. Also, join themajorityreport.com to become a member of this program. Keep us going.
This show.
This show, you know, the other one, the one you're actually here for. We will see you on the fun half.
Folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What, 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 what,
what, what, what,
what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what, what,
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.